Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and educator Dan Rosenberg. Rosenberg is a graduate of both the University of Georgia and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He is the author of four poetry collections, including Kadabra and The Crushing Organ, which won the American Poetry Journal Prize. His most recent, which we will discuss today, is a chapbook called Thighs Hollow, which was published in 2015 by Omnidon after winning their 2014 Poetry Chapbook Contest. Rosenberg also does translation work, and we'll discuss that as well. Dan Rosenberg teaches literature and creative writing at Wells College in Aurora, New York. And welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Tish.
Now, I always like to hear about a writer's beginning. Did you start writing as a kid? Were you encouraged by a writing family? What was it?
Oh, yeah. I did start writing as a kid. My mother loves to joke about me as a small child, pre-literate child, just sitting in my room crying. And she'd come in and she'd say, "What's wrong, Danny? What's wrong?" And I'd say, "I'll never learn to read like John, my older brother," who probably stopped reading for pleasure at about that age. And I went on to do this. But no, I think poetry started for me in middle school as a way to process sort of family trauma and personal drama and things like that. And then in high school, it became a way to feel clever. You know, I was reading John Donne, and I loved the sense that I understood what he was saying and other people around me didn't, which was obviously stupid. But it got me in. It got me hooked. It was the gateway, was that sense of, like, poetry is encoded in some way. And then it wasn't until college, really, where I had a great poetry teacher named Peter Richards who broke me of that habit in like a gentle, graceful way and really helped me see that what can be perceived as difficulty in poetry is not necessarily an encoding, but more of a struggle to articulate something that resists straightforward or conventional articulation.
Yeah. It's, you know, trying to interpret your emotions and feelings into a language is the challenge, I would say. Now, let's talk about your most recent chapbook, Thighs Hollow. I find it fascinating, and it almost feels like you're starting to explore a new language with it.
Yeah, well, it started really with the form. It's in a nonce form. It's in syllabics. So every line has the same number of syllables. Every poem has the same number of lines. So they all occupied the same sort of sonic space, and that was utterly arbitrary. That was just, I was in grad school, I was getting my MFA, and for whatever reason, I had this image of a pretzel vendor sprouting wings that just came into my head one day, and this was the form that seemed appropriate to it. And then the next poem also wanted to be in that form, and the next, and then I let the form sit for a while. The first poems in this chapbook actually predate the poems in Kadabra, my most recent book, and they predate some of the poems in my first book, actually. And it took me a while to come back to this and sort of rediscover that language. But when I did, it really opened a floodgate, and this chapbook is part of a much larger project that I'm still working on now.
Did you ever feel confined when you decide on a form like that, that you have to stay within the confines of?
I'm always working on more than one project at a time, and in that sense, no. Like, there are poems that aren't in the form that just happen. I feel the itch to write something that won't play with these other poems, and so I do that, and that goes in a separate folder somewhere. And what I found actually difficult as I was writing in this form and writing this form was that happened more and more infrequently. I started wondering if I was ever going to be able to write outside of this form again. So it wasn't inhibiting, but it became, in a way, the form allowed me to engage with language in a way that I was very excited to engage with it. And as my life got more complicated, my wife gave birth to our son, time became much scarcer. I found the form to be really generative to help me get into that headspace of writing a poem much more quickly.
So it sort of gave you discipline. That's interesting to me. So it's the opposite of what I was thinking might happen. I want to have you read a poem from Thighs Hollow. This one's called Suffused with What Grows Within Her.
Yeah, Suffused with What Grows Within
Suffused
Her.
Suffused with What Grows in Her. Within her. You want to tell us about it before you read it?
Sure, yeah. This was, I mentioned my wife gave birth to our son. He's now a year and a half old. And this poem I wrote when she was pregnant. And that was a tremendously joyful time for us, obviously. And Becca used the pregnancy as an excuse for very strange food cravings, but it was obviously and transparently a nonsense excuse because she's always had very strange food cravings. She'd always eat things that would make other people blanch. So yeah, I guess that's the context for this. Suffused with what grows within her. Akimbo beneath careful blankets, I nested her in my hearth, a stone cradle for the raising of what else but love and the sickness she's leaking. The plague head has descended upon my beloved in a cowl of snot. I can hear its uvula ringing about her like a meat bell. It slops, but she bears all. Smiles and arm flaps shifting the blankets like tattered wings, some feeble bat complaining. Yes, she wants burnt water steeped with vegetables, four silver fish split lengthwise and soaked in blood orange pulp and olive sweat. When I bring her food, she grows a beak from the still puddle her face has made. The beak has only the language of consumption dripping from it. My love calls for my offerings, says what grows within her is holy hunger, says there is no future but feeding and being fed. Inside her beak I see a small boy. He cries, he doesn't stop.
That is a fascinating poem. I bet your wife wondered, where in the hell did you get some of that from this?
she is my first reader and my first editor, and she helped me with this and with all of my poems. And I do the same for her. She's also a tremendous poet. And I think the physicality of pregnancy is something that she focused on a lot as well, and a sort of celebration of it. One of her favorite stories that appears in an essay that she wrote recently is about being very pregnant and going to the pool and swimming. She's a very good swimmer, and she would lap these young men, these bros who were clearly very proud of themselves, and she would just beat them, and then she would surge up out of the water, and they wouldn't have known that she was pregnant until that moment. And she's getting out of the pool, and she just watched them as she rose up. And so she had a great deal of pride and joy in her pregnant body, but was also aware of its shifts and its difficulties.
Yeah.
And that became very central to my experience of our domestic life as well. And so I think of this as a sort of loving and playful acknowledgement of something that often gets presented in an idealized fashion.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely a different take than one would be used to. I found it fascinating.
Well, it's fun. And I also, like, in the context of this work, I set this up and I framed it or referred to it as if I were the speaker here. But these poems began very much as persona poems, not the speaker was insistently not me. And strange things happen in this book that are unrelated to my real life. But as I kept working in the project, it crept closer and closer to my life, and that persona started collapsing more and more into myself. And in a way, this chapbook is a document of the beginning of that transition, where it starts off elsewhere and then the poetics shift and it becomes closer to a confessional voice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you know that this was going to be a complete collection? Did you have that as a deliberate thought in your mind, or was it all just being made as it happened?
I tend to write a poem at a time, and I don't know, and at a certain point I had a critical mass of them, and it felt like there was a shape there, and I have a terrible memory, so I had to go back and reread some that I had been working on obsessively and then put aside for a long time. And once I read through all of the ones that I'd written, there were some clear outliers that didn't fit in with the others that had to go. But there was very clearly a collection that could hang together and had a shape.
Yeah, oh, it definitely is. Are you somebody who maps out time to write? You have to have, you know, a couple hours, or do you just let the spirit move you? How does that work?
Oh, that has shifted since becoming a father. Pre-baby, I structured my life around having huge chunks of free time, and I would just sit at my desk and stare at the wall and call it working. And
that is working for a poet.
It is. And I don't have that time anymore. And so the process has shifted now. I steal scraps of time. I write late at night. I've been known to write in the bathroom, just wherever I can have a little bit of isolation and quiet. And I do need that. I've never been someone who could go to a big, noisy coffee shop and write.
Oh, I understand that, too. I don't know how people do that.
Yeah. I mean, if you can tune it out or if you can use it, then that's wonderful. I'm jealous. I just can't.
I think some people do find it stimulating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to have you read another from Thighs Hollow, because it's such a fascinating collection. I want to get all this in if we can. Bearing in Teeth My Invitation.
Bearing in Teeth My Invitation.
Your titles, we have to talk about that.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about it.
So this one of the threads working its way through this collection is a concern with faith, with Jewishness, which is the religion that I was raised in, and with faith and the divine more generally. And this is maybe the most explicitly Jewish poem in the pile. And I don't have a thesis about it, and I would hate to write a poem that had one, and I would hate to write a book that had one, but it's the worry. It's the worry that was sort of occupying the back of my brain, and this engages a little bit more directly than some of the others with it. So it's called Bearing in Teeth My Invitation. And I suppose I should mention, there are a lot of personal associations in this. John Berryman is an oblique antecedent to this whole project with his dream songs, and the sycamore that appears in this poem and is the setting for this poem is, in my mind, a tip of the hat to the sycamore that appears in the dream songs at the end of the first dream song. So, Bearing in Teeth My Invitation. Halfway through the sycamore, I am in sight of the red temple aloft, its blood gables and Star of David clutch between branches. Some new midrash burbles like sap stabbed into the air while I grip and hoist the stripping bark each grope exfoliates. My path is marked by yellow literate gashes. What I climb is heavy bearing name against me. Some parasite am I within as always leaping distance, but such terrestrial dirt am I, crawling the vertical respiring shade. I hear the synagogue settle for what flightless sacrifice I am reaching upward to the double gates, unfurled, as if the wings of justice were for me a thin water feature I pass through with paper-tasseled fists. The gnarled rabbis stumble their secret language into what seems one long name for a gentle God I can't buy, not here, not nameless, crawling upward I.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Dan Rosenberg. We're talking about his collection of poetry called Thighs Hollow. That poem has filled with so much layer and texture. It's really quite an amazing one, I think.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I find the propulsiveness of this form, because there's no punctuation in these poems, but there are caesurae, there are physical gaps in some of the lines that I use to try to control the rhythm and to try to give a resting point for a reader, and that can, if I'm working well with that form, lead to a sort of propulsiveness. And I always feel at the end of this poem that I have sort of lurched forward into something honest and then been pulled up short, and that is a sensation for an ending that I find very pleasing. So that's what I'm trying to do.
You get physical feelings from some of these lines. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
like pulled and
yeah, I think from other people's poetry, if I am going to love another, if I'm going to love a poem, it has to impact me physically and intellectually, because I'm also a huge nerd and I need to engage with my brain. I have a harder time with poems that are just pretty.
Oh, yeah.
I need to be challenged intellectually as well, but if I don't feel it in my body, I'm not interested. And the same thing very much holds true for my own work. I'll just throw it out if it doesn't do anything to me physically.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense to me. Now, tell me, your reading of these poems changes it for me. I think they're meant to be read out loud. How important do you think performing is? Is it something that you think people should concentrate more on? Because I do.
You do. I don't know. I'm torn because we are in this amazing historical moment where performances are globally accessible. You can find a video of many, if not most, contemporary poets who are publishing, reading their work somewhere. It's a Google search away. And that allows performance, which is this sort of intimate gesture, to actually reach a broad audience. So On the one hand, yes, absolutely. But I do think of these, and I do think of most of my work as for the page as well, because one of the downsides of a performance is that you are beholden to the reader's presentation of that work. And so these poems in particular, I think, often ask for you to pause and look back at the preceding line, because one of the things that I do in here, I think of as semantic doubling, where there's a word or a phrase that completes one thought and simultaneously begins the next one, but I don't repeat the phrase. So that can get tricky. That can get tangly. And I think it is probably hard to track if you're just hearing it once read aloud to you. So, I mean, honestly, I think the ideal way is probably to have the book in front of you and have someone read it.
Oh, yeah, I think that makes sense, too. But my point for the performing, and I think that people should concentrate more on it, is because I've seen poets ruin beautiful work by not knowing how to perform.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think MFA programs, whoever's teaching, should really concentrate on that. You can ruin your poem.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I think MFA programs are so varied and so diverse now, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I went, which is the Iowa Writers' Workshop, there was a graduate student reading series where current graduate students could share their work, but there was not an emphasis on this, and that's a program that very much understands itself as a studio space. Artists come here and are given 2 years to write and minimal responsibilities outside of just writing, and that's what you're here to do, and there's no real emphasis on teaching training afterwards, which those of us who graduate suddenly discover that the world doesn't give you food just because you say you're a writer.
And in fact, sometimes they throw it.
They
right?
do. Yeah, they'll give it to you if it's Rotten Tomatoes sometimes. But I also think learning how to read your poems can be immensely beneficial. And I host a reading series now up at Wells College, and I have my students open for the visiting poets who come and read. And part of how I pitch it to my students is I say, you will never understand your own work better than when you're reading it to a room full of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that reading aloud and reading to people, because you also should read aloud to yourself when you're writing and revising.
Yeah.
But something about the audience just, for me at least, dramatically shifts how I understand what I'm reading.
Yeah, interesting. I want to have you read one more from Thighs Hollow, Where Light Falls Less from Reflected Eyes.
Yeah, I suppose we should talk about titles at some point. Yeah,
we will,
And this is the last poem in the chapbook. And there have been a lot of visionary moments or poems in the book where the speaker sort of comes to in a space or just appears unpromptedly in a context and discovers it sort of as the poem goes. And this, I think, falls into that category. Where Light Falls Less from Reflected Eyes. I come to, enlarged in some cavern, the air I find insufficient for flexing, smelt my shoulder blades into a permanent splay. For blind years, I've been under wraps, T-shirts, disguises. I felt myself a human crawler, perched now on the cusp of unfurling here in the descent, in the darkness, with echoes of wings ever behind my physical ears. Do press and reach. The stalactites leak their slow, hard tears. I feel a mineral swelling in my brain. Rock leaks an alternate sky. The wet cavern wraps me, blurs the wind through my pricking shoulders. The primal calling, the ruffles upon the stone walls studded with crystals. They reflect my fierce, entombed growth. This sanguineous molting blinks me by slow accretion into being the endless cavern. Concave as skull innards, I'm worlded here in the cramp. I mind, I have mind, I am mind by the dark of the world.
Mm. So let's talk about titles. Honestly, your titles seem like mini poems themselves.
Well, they do follow the same rule of syllabics as the poems themselves. And I try to have the same sort of pressure on the language in the titles for this collection as I do in the poems. And titles are weird beasts because they're not in the poem, but they're of the poem.
Yeah.
And I think of a title as a way to prompt my reader in terms of how to prepare yourself for what's to come, like what kind of reading experience I'm asking you to participate in as a writer. And so I think a very semantically straightforward or even syntactically straightforward title would be misleading for these poems. Mm-hmm. Like they have to be a little bit twisted because the poems are a little bit twisted. And, you know, if I gave you a poem that said, you know, now I'm thinking about this Donald Justice poem and I want you to go and read it and then read this poem, that title would have no aesthetic relationship to the poem that followed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would be me stepping in and tapping you on the shoulder and saying, hey, let me tell you what you should be doing.
Oh.
Whereas I think of the title as like an invitation. Here's the game I'm playing.
Yeah.
Get on board and yeah. buckle up.
And, you know, I find titles really important because I can read a title and say, I'm not going to read that poem.
Mm-hmm.
That is a turnoff title. That doesn't mean anything to me, you know.
So did that happen?
No. I'm not talking. I read a lot of poetry.
Of course,
and poems in The New Yorker and some of that repetitious stuff that keeps being published, if you
yes.
ask me. And some of the titles, I think, okay, I'm turning the page. I'd rather read the ad.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that a title, and in a way, it's doing the work that I just described, right? That title is telling you, hey, look, here's another cute poem about an epiphany, and you can read this if that's what you're into, and more power to you, that's great. But if you are a reader who has read that poem a million times and doesn't want to engage with it again, thanks, title. You've saved me a couple minutes.
Exactly. That's why I find them important. You know, it saves time for the reader, and it engages us when we want to go there. Before we run out of time, let's talk about your translation work and this current book by the Slovenian poet.
Whose name I will pronounce.
I will not try to pronounce it, yes.
His name is Miklaus Komeo. And he is a young contemporary Slovenian poet. He is brilliant. And the great Slovenian poet Tomas Šalamon, who is probably the most famous poet from that country in America. Tomas actually has a much bigger footprint in America than in Slovenia, I would say. Like, he's obviously very famous and very well known there. But in terms of the influence on succeeding generations, Tomas, I think, has shaped the American poetry landscape that's sort of up and coming in a way that's really surprising. And he is the reason why I ended up co-translating this book.
Tell us the title.
The title is Hippodrome, or mm-hmm. Hippodrome,
mm-hmm.
Which, a clever bit of book design, the difference between a hippodrome in English and Hippodrome in Slovene is one extra P and one extra E, and if you look carefully at the title page, one P and one E are in gray rather than black as a way to get both titles in there, which I thought was a beautiful design element from the book designer.
So what's it like translating? Because I've read some of this poetry. You gave me the book. It seems like mystic stuff. So how do you know the intentions?
Yeah, thinking about that, I mean, we were lucky enough, my co-translator Boris Grigorich and I were lucky enough to be able to talk to the poet about our translations. But we didn't ask him about the poems before we gave them a shot at translating. We would send him our versions with some questions, and he would write back. And rarely, he would write back and say, oh my God, you guys are way off base. There were some things, like there is an anagrammatic poem in here where the original poem is the title repeated a few times, and then he just rearranges all of those letters to make the poem. It's a non-obvious process in a non-obvious form, and we had no idea that that's what had happened to that poem. So our translation didn't grapple with that at all, and he let us know. But intention is a tricky beast. We didn't feel like our job was to capture his intent. Our job was to try to create for an English language readership something akin to the experience that a Slovene language readership would have had of the original. So, because he is a willfully obscure poet at times. There's one moment in one poem where he spells a name two different ways, and I thought it was a typo, and I fixed it in the translation, and we sent him our version, and he wrote back this long thing saying he found this codex in this tiny bookstore in Italy, and in that codex, the author had spelled this name two different ways, and he thought of this as like a moment of difference in the Derrida sense. And he had this whole theory about what was going on, and I'm reading this letter, and I'm thinking, Miklaus, it's just going to look like a typo. No one is going to experience that. But that's the kind of poet that he is. He is someone who believes in the integrity of the work and is maybe less concerned with the audience reception. And so that gave us a little bit of freedom to have a lighter touch with these translations. We didn't feel the need to go ahead and explain too much because readers in Slovene could also leave many of these poems a little bit puzzled.
Yeah. So that's interesting to me that a poet isn't trying to communicate directly to people in some ways. You know? I mean, that's what it sounds like. He doesn't care if they understand.
Well, I think he would be displeased if people just like put the book down and said, I didn't have any reaction to this at all. But he is not uncomfortable with the idea of having moments in the poem that are opaque to certain readers, or moments in the poem that feel to a reader private. and that the reader doesn't have access to.
I see.
And I think he can create those moments in part by, like, honoring the context in which this poem arose in a way that's non-obvious to a reader but important to him.
Read one of the poems. It's a fascinating little lyric.
Sure. This one is untitled, actually, and there are several untitled poems in this. And our translation goes, "A snowflake falls on a forehead which changes into the white-hot side of a stove. In the black, gray, and white colors of the ash, I can't find the color that has burned away. The dark and distant interior of the body shaken by the bonds of red and blood."
That was fascinating to me. It had to do with death and...
Absolutely.
And you know, maybe even war.
Yeah, you had noted that there's a certain sort of mystical feel, and I think connecting it to war is a really interesting moment because poets from Slovenia and from Eastern Europe in general often have a much stronger political sense than American poets.
Yeah, exactly.
And less of a sense that the political and the personal are separate fields. They're very much connected. And for Miklaus, history is very much connected. Even our title, we struggled with the title Hippodrome because in Slovene, the Hippodrome is like the ancient Greek and Roman hippodromes, mm-hmm. the horse tracks. But it's also the contemporary horse track where you could go and bet on the horses. In English, we don't have one word for those two things. The ancient history and the modern experience are not united in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very much united in this book, and the title was sort of clearly meant to reflect that. And so we were struggling with what do we even call it, because we could have called it The Racetrack and that wouldn't have been wrong.
Yeah. But that title reminds me of something ancient. And of course these countries are, and it seems like the writers that come from those countries are steeped in that history always.
And the history, and to call, you're right, like there's this long history, but Slovenia is a very young country.
It is.
A very old culture that has existed mm-hmm. for a very long time. I think, from its founding sometime in mythology, it's actually in an ancient Greek. I want to say Jason was the mythological founder of the city that would become Ljubljana, that would be the heart of Slovenia. But they have certainly been part of a larger geopolitical entity
mm-hmm.
from as long back as there was an idea of a thing called Slovenia and a language called Slovene up until the dissolution of Yugoslavia.
Yeah, that's a fascinating book. I have got to read the whole thing.
Yeah,
we are almost out of time. So, what are you working on now? We expect anything new to come through?
The next project is actually in the form and sort of a continuation and expansion of Thighs Hollow, the chapbook. I think there's a full draft. It's in that space now where I have gone through and I've been revising and I've excised some poems that no longer fit in the shape that the larger body has become. And I think this is the end of this project. But it's actually, this Thighs Hollow is a chapbook and this next thing is a full-length book, all in this form as well. So
wow, we'll look forward to that. That sounds fascinating, Dan. Can you give contact information if people want to get in touch with you?
Oh, sure. Yeah, please, by all means. I'm drosenberg@wells.edu. You can always just search for me. And danrosenberg.us is the website, and there's a contact form there as well.
Great. Well, Dan Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure to discover your work and share it with our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.